On this week in Enterprise Tech, will autonomous vehicles soon come into view from a bunch of car makers? Well, startup Aurora thinks so. Zero Rating is coming back on the topic of net neutrality, and we have a full house with Brian McHenry, Heather Williams, and Brian Chi as we talk about returning guest Tim Titus about SMP and whether NetConf is the way of the future. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 328, recorded February 8th, 2019. NetConf is your Babelfish. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by ThousandEyes. Companies that run in the cloud rely on ThousandEyes. It's the place they go first to see, understand, and improve the digital experience of their cloud-based applications and services. Do the cloud right and improve services for your customers and employees today. Visit ThousandEyes.com/TWIT. And by Atlassian. Atlassian software powers the full spectrum of collaboration between IT teams and the rest of your organization. Visit Atlassian.com/IT to see what IT can be by giving their products a try for free. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the brains of this outfit because today we're talking all about networking. And what better way to do that than bring in not one, but three enterprise professionals on the topic, starting with our geek in paradise and the director of Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, how's the weather down there in Hawaii?
The wind is starting to pick up, and we are being told to expect 60-foot waves coming this weekend. So that storm system is going to be dumping rain and wind and all that stuff. And then it's going to, when it's done with us, it's going to head to California. So California, you're getting our rain.
Well, we're looking at snowpocalypse here today in the Pacific Northwest. So everyone is in their houses, recouped and cooped all up here. We'll see if my network can stay up during that time. But you know, we need to stack the deck on this show today, and we're adding not one but two but three people, and we want to bring in not even add to that winning combo and bring in Heather Williams, Senior Product Solutions Architect of Rutgers Network. Welcome back, Heather.
Hey, thanks for having me back, guys.
You bet. Like you have a roller coaster of temperatures down there as well, right?
I think we've had three seasons in the last 4 days. So it's now I was in shorts yesterday and I'm back to a jacket and I've got the heater running today. I can't complain compared to what you're going through, but yeah, it's a little different.
Well, folks, I told you we're stacking the deck and we're adding another ace in the hole with Mr. Brian McHenry, Director of Global Security Solutions at F5 Networks. Great to have you back, Brian.
It's always good to be back. Thanks, Lou.
You bet. Now, you're getting ready to – you're revving up to go to RSA pretty soon here, right?
Yeah. My annual pilgrimage to San Francisco and the Moscone Center. 50,000 of my best friends will be there. And looking forward to talking web app firewalls and SSL decryption to anybody that wants to swing by the F5 booth while I'm there.
Fantastic. Well, folks, we actually got quite the show about networking today. We're going to take you through the lay of the land and how enterprises are looking for visibility into their networks and services. But before we do and go through all that goodness, let's go ahead and just jump into the blips. Now, if you're like me, you're as anxiously wanting or waiting for technology around self-driving vehicles. Here on TWiT, we predicted several times that self-driving vehicles will become a true reality in the next couple of years. Well, the startup Aurora might be one of those companies that can take us there. With their latest Series B investments of $530 million, they're now valued at $2 billion, with partnerships with the Volkswagen Group, Hyundai, and electric vehicle startup Byton. The company is positioning itself to take the lead in self-driving vehicles. They're assembling a dream team with hires that include SpaceX's head of technology or engineering, leaders from Google's self-driving projects, and people who lead the Tesla Autopilot team. Aurora's self-driving software uses data from sensors, such as cameras and radars, to perceive the world around it and then plan for a safe path forward. The company's engineering group follows the saying, Don't try to build a ladder to the moon, meaning you'll never practically reach a goal if you don't try to take risks by constructing the right systems the first time by learning from others' mistakes. Now, they learn from simulations and real-world regression tests, allowing them to serve as the constraints to their systems. Their software gives a smooth, predictable, human-like behavior, which is subjected to constraints that the behavior must correctly handle the battery of real-world and simulated cases. Now, with their sophisticated learning software, no wonder Amazon has taken interest and is also part of that recent $530 million investment in Aurora. If any company can bring help and bring us to where we need to be with autonomous vehicles in the next couple of years, Aurora will be the one to watch.
Well, we've often wanted to tame the wild world, wild west of security product testing. As someone who's been an enterprise security architect in the past, I never know for sure if I can trust those data sheet numbers from firewall vendors and IPS and the like. And so we've always needed this open industry standard testing framework that's never really come to pass and hasn't been updated. The vast majority of major data breaches occur due to poorly patched or poorly secured devices. And even DDoS attacks are subject to things like poor performance and firewalls. These devices themselves are security devices. To date, there's no open standard for performance testing and similarly poor oversight of the security of those systems outside of the product vendor's own testing. In particular, the shift from over 80% of HTTP traffic being unencrypted, doing a complete 180, to now over 80% of HTTP traffic being encrypted by Transport Layer Security, or TLS, the successor protocol of SSL. Standards for testing and measuring performance and capability of network security devices have not been updated to reflect this. The net effect is that many of the security claims made by a firewall, IPS, anti-malware, and other product vendors are often impossible to achieve in a real-world scenario. To provide meaningful inspection, these network security devices are often almost entirely dependent on a third-party decryption solution or a big asterisk for performance degradation due to on-box TLS decryption of that traffic. NetSec Open is working to solve this problem for security architects in the enterprise, looking to be more make more informed decisions about the devices they deploy in their infrastructures. NetSec Open was founded in 2017 as a joint project among vendors and testing labs to develop new industry standards. Founding members include Checkpoint, Cisco, Fortinet, Palo Alto Networks, SonicWall, Sophos, and WatchGuard, test solution and service vendors Spirent and Ixia, and Testing Labs European Advanced Network Test Center and the University of New Hampshire's Interoperability Lab are all involved. The goal is to provide a standard for all testing labs so that apples-to-apples comparisons are possible regardless of the product vendor, the test rig, or the test lab.
A Huawei sting offers a rare glimpse at the U.S. targeting a Chinese giant. It's a Bloomberg story that's part Revenge of the Nerds meets James Bond, and it's more bad news for Huawei. Worse, this investigation has nothing to do with the recently announced grand jury indictments against Huawei, which include the CFO being charged with multiple counts of fraud and conspiracy, and a separate case with charges of theft and of trade secrets, conspiracy, and obstruction of justice. On January 28th, the FBI issued a press release stating, "These charges lay bare Huawei's alleged blatant disregard for the laws of our country and standard global business practices." That same day, a secret FBI raid searched a Huawei lab in San Diego. It all started a year ago when Acon Semiconductor sent a sample of their new smart screen technology to that lab for testing. Since they're a small company with a product that could be taking on Corning and Gorilla Glass, more on that in a moment, Acon Semiconductor needed to convince the world that big smartphone manufacturers like Apple, Samsung, and Huawei, that its product is even tougher than Gorilla Glass. The sample that was shipped went out in a tray lined with silicon gel and closed in a plastic case surrounded by airbags and sealed in a cardboard box. When it was finally returned months after the deadline, the packaging was destroyed, the sample cracked, and pieces of it were missing. More interesting is that the FBI came calling soon thereafter and asked Acon officers to participate in an investigation of Huawei. What followed were meetings between Acon and Huawei in Vegas at last month's Consumer Electronics Show, CES, that were recorded with surveillance devices and observed from a distance by a Bloomberg reporter. And as fascinating as this story is about the investigation, and I really do recommend that you read the full article, what's really exciting is what the article shares about Acon's nearly indestructible smartphone screen called Mirage Diamond Glass. It's 6 times stronger and 10 times more scratch resistant than Gorilla Glass. Kahn called it lighter, thinner, faster, and stronger, and promises that it will lead to a fundamental next level in design. Kahn's work on diamond glass goes back to his college days when he began learning about so-called nano diamonds and eventually developed and patented a way to deposit a thin coating of tiny diamonds on materials such as glass. There's a joke in there about diamonds being a girl's best friend somewhere, but all I can think is that maybe I should go to CES next year.
Well, the House Democrats tell Ajit Pai, stop screwing over the public. Democratic lawmakers have put Federal Communications Commission Chairman Ajit Pai on notice that he can expect a lot more scrutiny now that Democrats control the U.S. House of Representatives. The House Commerce Committee is reassuming its traditional role of oversight to ensure the agency is acting in the best interest of the public and consistent with its legislative authority. Commerce Committee Chairman Frank Pallone Jr., Democrat from New Jersey, and Communications and Technology Subcommittee Chair Mike Doyle, Democrat from Pennsylvania, said in an announcement the other day. Pallone Jr. and Doyle wrote a letter to Pai saying that he has made the FCC too secretive and has repeatedly advanced the interests of corporations over consumers. They wrote, and I quote, "Not only have you failed on numerous occasions to provide Democratic members of this committee with responses to their inquiries, you have also repeatedly denied or delayed responding to legitimate information requests from the public about agency operations. These actions have denied the public of a full and fair understanding of how the FCC under your leadership has arrived at public policy decisions that impact Americans every day in communities across the country." Continuing, "Under your leadership, the FCC has failed repeatedly to act in the public interest and place the interest of corporations over consumers. The FCC should be working to advance the goals of public safety, consumer protection, affordable access, and connectivity across the United States. To that end, it is incumbent upon the committee's leadership and its members to oversee the activities of the FCC." And my comment is, we can only hope that the voice of the people will actually be heard this time.
Now, there are many people who believe that cryptocurrencies are the unicorn of the tech industry, and they're really more of a myth than a reality. Well, Nicholas Weaver is one of those skeptics. He's a researcher at UC Berkeley's International Computer Science Institute, has characterized Bitcoin and its many follow-on digital currencies as energy-sucking leeches with no redeeming qualities. Now, with this level of experience and intelligence, Weaver has pretty good claims and backs up his claims. Weaver has laid out a variety of reasons why cryptocurrencies make a poor substitute for use of payment cards, checks, and old-fashioned cash. Now, let's go ahead and through some of them here. Cryptocurrency transactions are expensive because cryptocurrencies are supposed to have no central authority that can reverse a transaction, and they are, quote, fundamentally incompatible with the modern financial system, which means the pipeline to take care of those expenses, retailers actually have to issue their own credits or hold on to it to see if it gains value, and the value is turbulent over time, so it's actually very expensive. Number two, cryptocurrencies are deflationary. Now, this means that the longer someone holds on to a cryptocurrency, the more goods and services it will buy. Well, as Weaver puts it, in a deflationary currency, rule one is never spend your currency. Less than 10,000 Bitcoin pizza fill your stomach with a Breaking Bad pile of regret a few years down the road. Now, I love that Breaking Bad reference there. Now, number three, cryptocurrencies are hard to hold because based off of a survey of people who have stored large amounts of cryptocurrency in a hot wallet, they will almost inevitably say their wallet has been stolen. That makes cryptocurrencies a major inconvenience and a liability. Now, a couple other myths that Weaver calls out is, number one, cryptocurrencies are decentralized. Now, in theory, that is actually true, but in practice, they are actually a quasi-central authority, which exists. Consider that the 2016 bailout of the DAO, a crowdsourced investment fund, after hacks actually swindled out $50 million worth of Ethereum. Now, number two, blockchains will revolutionize X, which means cryptocurrencies rely on a permissionless chain of hashes to verify a public ledger of all previous transactions. Now, the rise of cryptocurrencies has spawned renewed energy in permissioned or private chains that supposedly can be used in new ways to keep records. The problem, Weaver said, is that these chains have existed for decades in the form of hash chains and have already been used or just about anything that could benefit from it. Now, this creates an interesting perspective of cryptocurrencies and blockchains that people are overlooking with all the hopes of making it rich. Now, this might just raise a couple eyebrows for investors and technologies alike, and maybe even cause an interesting pivot in the industry to look for something else to secure our digital future.
Windows 7 is dead, or almost dead, but long live Windows 7. Microsoft's Windows 7 operating system is scheduled to go end of support in January 2020. With many large enterprises standardized on the desktop operating system, Microsoft is rolling out a new program called Extended Security Updates, or ESU. This program will be available to any volume licensed customer, unlike previous extended support offerings, which were typically negotiated as part of the largest enterprise agreements. The cost of the support per device will double each year up to 3 years, incentivizing customers to migrate to a new desktop OS standard. One way to avoid this escalating cost to maintain Windows 7 in your enterprise is to adopt Microsoft's Windows Virtual Desktop Service, which will receive ESU service at no additional charge. Obviously, Microsoft is hoping many customers will choose this service offering, and securing access to virtual desktops becomes the next stop in the so-called cyber kill chain when it comes to desktop access. In a way, this increasing shift to virtual desktops increases overall security by keeping desktop operating systems well-patched and freeing up enterprise security teams to focus on the control of identity and implementing stronger federation and multi-factor authentication solutions.
Zero rating, another way of poisoning net neutrality. Last week, I talked about the oral arguments being made in the U.S. Court of Appeals in a lawsuit to overturn the FCC's 2017 repeal of open internet rules. In that blip, I referred to ISPs being patient in their bad practices because while net neutrality was killed in 2017, there is still some hope for a resurrection, and ISPs are playing the long con. This week, a study found that zero rating actually costs you more money in the end. Zero rating is what ISPs call it when they make data access to some sites either free or cheaper, and it's one of the big lies that we're told to make consumers think that they would benefit from the end of net neutrality. Zero rating is what allows me, for example, to stream DirecTV to my mobile devices across my AT&T cellular connection, and it doesn't apply to any data cap. If you're a Virgin Mobile subscriber, you would get the same benefit when you use apps like Twitter or WhatsApp. So what could possibly be wrong with that? The problem is that there's no such thing as a free lunch, and someone has to foot the bill for the bandwidth usage. So if it's costing you less to do one thing, it turns out it's going to cost you more to do something else. And if you're the kind of person who wants to use internet services because they add value to your life or you need them for work, it's not helpful that your ISP is offering other services for free because they're going to charge you more for what you wanted to use anyway. And more than that, it's going to end up being expensive. A study done by Epicenter Works, a nonprofit that studies the effects of technology on people, did a study on zero rating within the EU's 30 member countries. And they found that when a country allowed zero rating, wireless carriers increased wireless data charges compared to those without zero rating. And Ernesto Falcon, the Electronics Frontier Foundation Legislative Council, observed EU countries that do not have zero rating practices enjoyed a double-digit drop in the price of wireless data after a year. In comparison, the countries with prevalent zero rating practices from their wireless carriers consistently saw data prices increase. The reason is simple. Once you've signed a contract with a service provider, you're unlikely to change carriers. For far too many regions in the U.S., there are no alternative carriers, even as this practice helps eliminate the smaller ISPs, which means the ISPs got exactly what they wanted, and we get higher bills and fewer choices.
IoT security's coming of age is long overdue. Security always lags behind technology adoption, and a few technologies have seen growth as explosive as the Internet of Things. Despite the rapid maturation of the market for connected devices, security has been an afterthought until now, creating an unprecedented opportunity for hackers worldwide. Well, it's 2019 and the industry is overdue for a new comprehensive security model for connected devices. Quote, one that reflects the challenges of protecting IoT's position at the confluence of software and device security. The unique threat landscape requires a novel security approach based on the latest advances in network and artificial intelligence security. It is in the best interest of the entire internet community to stop treating residential security in such a cavalier attitude. By doing our part to use more robust devices, we reduce the potential attack surface to be used by botnets and malware hackers.
Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have a really great guest, Tim Titus, to talk about NetComp and more. But before we get to that, we have a great sponsor we want to thank, and that is Thousand Eyes. Now, have you ever watched those action and sci-fi movies where they show you the war rooms and they have tons of screens on the wall with all the data from their network? Wouldn't it be cool if that could be a reality? Well, imagine if you had a thousand eyes. You already know that the internet is the backbone of organizations, enterprises. It's a complex network of nodes and data. And when your business depends on it, you need to have deep insights into the health and performance of it at all times. Now, Thousand Eyes is going to make it easier for you and your organization. Now, nowadays, with tons of cloud apps, PaaS and SaaS services like Office 365, WebEx, Salesforce, and more, you have to have a view or a lay of the land of the network and the internet at all times. You need to know how it could or is affecting your customers and their user experiences. Well, it's in the company name. They give you more than 1,000 eyes to surface the data you need to provide the best-in-class service and view of your network. You might say, well, it's got to be hard to set up and deploy and get started. Well, 1,000 Eyes has found a way to make it easy to deploy and start collecting data in no time. They have a concept of networking agents. You deploy agents throughout your network, and you're instantly able to visualize, monitor, and diagnose your networks. Now, whether you deploy on a virtual appliance or Hyper-V appliance or others, they really make it easy to start getting valuable information about the network that affect your business. Now, these agents are sensors that are deployed globally and give a pulse data of what's going on with the network. Now, imagine if you have users or customers complaining about their access to a service because it's a bit slow for them in Japan, let's say. Well, your cloud agent in Japan can give you data and that you need to diagnose where in the network is causing the issue. Now, global sets of customers are not a problem for 1,000 Eyes. They give you the vantage point of the network you need to diagnose and solve. Now, they also have a concept of enterprising agents as well, which work the same ways inside the enterprise, whether they are at a branch office or a data center. They can give you a hybrid end-to-end view of the entire network. Now, having used the power of 1,000 Eyes, it makes you feel like you are in the driver's seat of your network and services, and they make it easy to follow as well. 1,000 Eyes also puts themselves in the point of view of your customers and end users with their endpoint agents as well. They can get a view of the customers and what they're actually seeing. Now, all that data is collected, aggregated, and processed and correlated for patterns across all the agents and data sets. It truly is network intelligence. Now, it helps you collectively make sense out of all your data. Now, 1,000 Eyes actually puts themselves into the brain and eyes of a network engineer or IT professional. You probably envision your network looking a certain way with interconnected nodes. Now, you can't troubleshoot a network by looking at area charts, bar graphs, and line graphs. You need visualizations of that network spatially. Well, 1,000 Eyes provides beautiful real-world sets of visualizations that encapsulate the complexity of your network. They actually give you the data you need to run and proactively and reactively run that network well. 1,000 Eyes helps you solve real-world issues with unique, actionable data and super great visualizations. Now, whether it's IP forwarding issues, BGP, VoIP, wireless LAN, internet outages, or more, 1,000 Eyes has you covered. They even have monitors and mitigation strategies for network attacks like DDoS and more. Dr. Mohit Lad is the co-founder and CEO of 1,000 Eyes. He has experience of over a decade of designing and implementing systems and solving really hard networking problems. And he and all the other extraordinary people at 1,000 Eyes will help you and your organization do the same. Regain control of your network and ensure the best possible experience for your customers and employees. Visit 1000eyes.com/twit to see what you've been missing. You'll get the exclusive ebook on the 5 cloud migration challenges you shouldn't ignore. If the cloud is important to you, either today or in the future, visit 1000eyes.com/twit. That's 1000eyes.com/twit. 1,000 Eyes, thrive in a connected world. And we thank 1,000 Eyes for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, this is my favorite part of the show. We're going to bring a guest in to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Please help me welcome back Mr. Tim Titus, CTO of PaaS Solutions. Welcome back, Tim. See, you're actually in the studio there.
Yeah. Thanks, Lou.
You bet. So we have some pretty interesting topics today. We're going to include some NetConf, the Network Configuration Protocol. But first, maybe you could tell us, kind of give us a lay of the land. Where are we going? What are networking teams doing today, and how are they moving along?
Well, so I have a little bit of a history lesson I want to share, and so hopefully I won't put anyone to sleep. But effectively, SNMP was created ages ago. I'm going to say, actually, I don't have the date on that, but I'm going to say in the 90s. And it was created really with two purposes. The two purposes were to collect information and be able to analyze what is the network doing. And the second part of SNMP with a read-write community string was to be able to, say, change the configuration of devices. The problem is most vendors never got around to doing that part. And so you never got to be able to say, gee, let's go change the configuration of devices. So people are stuck having to manually use CLIs. Sometimes they'll use scripting tools. They'll use a little bit of automation to say, hey, put this script out on 20 different devices at the same time. So they use some configuration management tools like that. But it's still all being forced through the CLI and the limitations of these CLIs on every one of these devices. So that's really the history of kind of where we've been stuck as an industry for quite some period of time.
Right now, when you talk a little bit about CLIs, and I've noticed that a lot of networking people have said, hey, you know, I have to write these specific CLI scripts for every specific device that's out there. And my devices that have a very heterogeneous network, so that takes a lot of time. Where are we going to kind of correct that?
And that's exactly the purpose of NetConf. So you were talking about the heterogeneous networks. Yeah, everyone's got that old 3COM hub that they just can't seem to get rid of that's sitting in the back closet somewhere. But you might have some HP equipment. You have six different varieties of CLI from Cisco, from your Cisco equipment, your Nexus OS. Maybe you have some old PIC stuff, whatever. You have so many different CLIs, and you have to put on a different hat every time you log into a different device. And so that's where everyone tends to get stuck into thinking, if I only had one master controller where I could go in and orchestrate all of this, then the world would be an awesome place. And so that was the thinking back in 2002. Both Juniper and Cisco got together, strange bedfellows, yes, but they got together and said, we need to create an IETF standard. We need to create a standards body to focus on doing configuration management. And that's really where, in 2003, the NetConf working group was officially organized. Now, the problem is that that's 2003. That's a long time ago. Really, right. No work was done up until roughly about 2010, 2011, when they actually started doing regular meetings and they started to describe how should this protocol work. So it's taken quite some time for the industry to actually start moving on this. And I find it interesting is that usually for anything to move in the industry, you need to have money behind it. In other words, there has to be a business reason that somebody says this technology needs to be done and it needs to be done now versus later. And there's a cost with that. So NetConf was really pushed starting 2010, 2011 by carriers. And the reason is that carriers will sit there and say, gee, we've got thousands of switches, thousands of routers that we need to manage, and we need to do this in an efficient way. And the scripting is not doing it. And in a certain sense, they wanted to have a standards way of doing this so that it could apply to carriers that acquired other carriers. If you have a situation where Level 3 and CenturyLink merge, and it's like one's using Cisco and one's using Juniper, they still need to have common orchestration. So if that was done as a standard, then that means you can manage across that entire infrastructure. So that's part of the game as to what they were focused on doing. And with that money behind it, they said this is now a business reason to move forward and actually start building on this platform.
Right. Now, you talked a little bit about how vendors have to kind of adhere to these standards. And we kind of want that whole North Star of interoperability, which means that hardware and software kind of talk together really easily on the same network. You know, how does NetConf going to help that? And do the vendors actually have to, do we have to have vendors kind of buy into it to do it?
So, yeah, they do have to buy into it. It is optional. There's nothing, you know, I don't think they're going to make this mandatory by any reasons, but having vendors do this just means that they're going to increase the ability to sell the devices. Now, so far, what I've seen is that we're probably at a state right now where it's very early on as far as equipment that actually has NetConf support. I would beg to say that I think that's probably about 10% of the equipment you can buy on the market today has NetConf support, But I would expect that over the next 3 years, that's going to probably increase to something like 40%. And I think once we hit that 40%, it's just going to be a sea change where if you have a device, you know, by 4 years from now, 5 years from now, if you have a device that doesn't support NetConf, people are going to think, why would I want to buy this? I want to have that common orchestration, and NetConf is going to be the way to do it.
Makes sense. Now, if we can, maybe we could just go through some of the, because the protocol has been around for a while. Can we maybe talk a little bit about some of the advantages that we hear about? I hear things like configuration testing and validation support kind of built in. What are some of the other major advantages that NetConf bring along?
Well, so the first thing is you're eliminating the CLI, so you don't have that learning curve. I got to admit to you guys, is I get a new box, I get excited, I set it up in my lab, plug it in, turn it on, and say, oh, there's a new CLI. Okay, I'm thinking question mark, probably gives me help. Okay, there's a little bit of help here. But we all kind of muddle through it. And that it's that muddling that ends up being, you know, it might take you 20 minutes to learn how to set up a single interface because you're still learning, how do I communicate with this box? All of that is going to be eliminated so that you can say, I don't care what vendor this box is. I don't care what the manufacturer is. I don't care what OS is on this. I'm going to have a common way to configure it, saying, I want these ports on these VLANs with this configuration and this sort of DSCP tagging. And it's just going to automatically happen because you're able to talk to the box no matter what the vendor is or what the OS that's running on that box. So I think that's going to end up speeding the ability to do deployments, where you can say, you know, many companies every 5 years, they will turn over their network and say, we need to have modern supported equipment here. We need to have a network refresh done. That network refresh is going to be even faster and more stable and reliable simply because the configuration is not going to be a limiting factor of, hey, we got to slow down. We have a problem configuring this gig interface to actually communicate on the right VLAN and trunk correctly. Setting up trunking is going to be easy because it's now a standard way of doing it. So it's kind of like if we could all speak English to our network instead of, gee, when I talk to Cisco, I speak English. When I talk to a Juniper box, I have to speak Spanish. When I end up talking, you know, Greek to this old 3Com box that I have. So instead of having multiple languages on the engineer, it's going to be one common understanding of, here's how to do NetConf. I don't care what the devices are. And that's going to further move equipment into their capabilities and not the mechanism of configuring.
Right, right. Well, it's all Greek to me. But, you know, we talked about how CLIs are going to be replaced and how we had to write different scripts for different hardware. Is there an alternative as we move into NetConf? Obviously, that we still need to be able to script things. We still need to be able to customize things. What are we moving forward? What's the alternative here?
Well, so the only thing I'm familiar with really is that NetConf is going to end up being the replacement. There's a secondary push from below. And what I mean by push from below is you have things like Meraki where they're all cloud managed. And so there's no CLI. You log into a cloud system and you manage your hardware that way. And this is going to rise from below, whereas you're going to have small pizza shops that say, yeah, we've got a Meraki Wi-Fi box, we've got a Meraki firewall, we've got a Meraki phone sitting here and a Meraki camera, and it plugs into our point of sale system and we're done. And so that's going to be those really small organizations. But you're going to have those organizations grow where now you've got 20 of those deployments for 20 of those pizza shops. These organizations are going to grow to the point where they say, gee, we've got 200 people working in our headquarters, and it's still all cloud managed. And so that's going to make it so that you're able to manage it through that web UI. And you can say, gee, we're going to get rid of and outsource some of our networking. You can now have an outsource company do that. And there's really no change. You just give them the login and they can do that from cloud management. So that's kind of the second competing technology. And so I think small to medium sized companies are all going to use this cloud management. And the large organizations are just going to be adopting NetConf like crazy, figuring that that's how you manage those, you know, 400 or even 4,000 switches and routers inside the infrastructure. And both of those will meet somewhere in the middle and just squish out CLI to the point where CLI is going to be like, you know, how many of you remember DOS? Do you ever drop into a DOS prompt? That's just going to go away.
Oh, poor DOS. Poor DOS. Well, when we come back, we obviously have a lot more material to talk about here. And of course, I want to bring in all my co-hosts. They're professionals and experts in this area. They have some great questions. So we'll talk a little bit more when we come back. But before we do, we have to thank another really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Atlassian. Now, whether you're an engineering team that develops software or other products, you probably have used Atlassian's products or two. Now, I remember back in 2002, way back, Atlassian launched a product that was really perfectly timed to meet the needs of the emerging generation, which are developers committed to agile principles. Now, originally, it was conceived as a bug tracking tool. The Jira ticket quickly became the digital record of choice for tracking units of work in highly collaborative agile development teams. Well, fast forward 16 years, DevOps is on everyone's docket, and Atlassian is still leading the pack in the areas that helps teams rise to the occasion. Now, Atlassian really is a collaboration software company that empowers teams around the world. Like all organizations, you want to ship products faster, more efficient, with higher quality, and ensure your customers' feedback loop adds to the business value proposition. Now, sometimes businesses fall short with the different workflows they've implemented. Well, just like that, they have been doing it for over 16 years, and this is where Atlassian's wheelhouse comes in. They give you and your organization the power to manage complex collaborations. Now, plus their tools and services are not just for developers. Atlassian offers an affordable, reliable suite of tools for teams of all sizes, from DevOps to Agile, IT apps to Ops, to ITSM, and whatever's next. Now, Atlassian provides the technology backbone to help modern IT organizations plan service and support the kind of change that propels their business. Now, with Jira Software, Confluence, and Bitbucket, Atlassian forms the backbone of effective cross-team project planning, organization, and communication. Now, with Jira Ops, OpsGenie, and Status Page, they help teams to better detect incidents and alert response teams, coordinate response efforts to resolve issues faster, and keep customers or stakeholders updated along the way. Now, your teams can choose tools that are right for your current framework while trusting as you grow, they can grow with you. Now, it all integrates seamlessly with Jira and Confluence, and which keeps your team from bouncing around from platform to platform. Now, I use Bitbucket as a repository all the time for many of my projects. They even have features that others don't. If you haven't already, go check them out right now. Like all of Atlassian's products, the tools for your IT team are easy and free to try. Just head to Atlassian.com/IT to find out which Atlassian offering is right for your team. Try Atlassian today to see what IT can be. That's Atlassian.com/IT. And we thank Atlassian for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we're talking with Tim Titus, CTO of Pass Solutions, and we're talking about NetConf and how we're hoping that this protocol will kind of pick up in the industry. Tim, I want to bring in my co-host in crime. I'm going to start with Mr. Brian Chi. He's kind of chomping at the bit behind the scenes here, and he's has some questions for you about adoption and so on.
Well, it's kind of along the lines of NetConf is one of those things that's being, I think, is being driven by ISPs. So I've actually been through AT&T training and so forth. And when we start getting into having to write really, really complex procedures on how to provision, say, a home modem, a residential modem, and you have to do this hundreds or thousands of times per day, when you start having to use command line and you get an upgrade, it's going to change. And you start getting errors. And this is one of the things that I'm starting to learn as I'm standing up a wireless internet service provider, is that NetConf seems to be the way a lot of ISPs are going. Now, so let's put this into a question. Do you think that NetConf is going to be the babelfish? Let's call it a babelfish, where we're going to start having the ability to have a lot more common things happening so that you don't have so many different languages. NetConf being more API driven, I believe you're going to have more things that can happen. You'll have more people developing software that's going to let basically reduce training curves. I threw a lot of things out there, but do you think it's going to be the babelfish? Is it going to do a lot of translation for us?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's the awesomeness that's going to happen. in the scroll I have here is Specs just said the larger the organization, the larger the benefits. Smaller orgs will probably be the holdouts. That's exactly true, because the smaller organization can say, I will just use the web UI to configure this Netgear switch and I'm good to go. But once you end up having 10 or 20 or 50 network devices, that's where you're going to have this, especially if you have specific needs to say, okay, I need to have an F5 box doing this. I need to have a Cisco box over here doing this. I need to have HP switches just to cover the mass number of people here at a low cost. So with all of that diversity in the environment, Babelfish, I think, is a great description of this. They probably should have named the working group that, because it's going to solve that problem of one person can do all that configuration. Whereas these days, what has to happen is you have that one network engineer and they have to be skilled in F5 to be able to properly configure it. Or they're on the phone to those great support folks and saying, hey, here's how to do that to get that done. Increases the amount of time spent by everybody. But if you had that one Babelfish, here's what I want to do. Here's how I want to do it, how I want to configure the traffic flows. Here are the changes that can happen dynamically. And again, having it so that it's able to read through SNMP and say, this is what the traffic flows are, this is what the utilization is, and then be able to do dynamic changes, meaning let's open up some additional paths. It costs us more money to have these dynamic network paths, but let's open those up so that we don't have any slowdowns happening. That means now you can start putting business rule sets in place. And this is something that really Cisco is kind of the only company starting down that path of having that dynamic network where business rules can drive how does that network operate. NetConf is going to make it so that business rules can be applied all over the place, and you're just going to go to your NetConf dashboard and say, this is how I want this network to perform under these different circumstances with these different time frames, and it's going to be vendor independent, which makes it incredibly powerful.
So, Tim, what do you think? I'm going to do a what if, crystal ball. I personally think NetConf, one of the issues are going to be repeatability and documentation. Being able to have something that's, nice and consistent, especially when you have a procedural based system. Like for instance, the AT&T training I went through, you have to do MOPS and SMOPS and things like that, which are basically English language scripts for how you're going to do a procedure. Do you think NetConf is going to help or hurt this kind of movement?
It's definitely going to help. It can create some of that based upon the fact that so NetConf, by the way, you're going to hear NetConf along with Yang, Y-A-N-G. It's kind of funny as Yang is the configuration language that is used. So NetConf is actually just like – it's like HTTP. It's the communications protocol, but HTML, the definition of the page – is like Yang. It's this is what the configuration is going to be. So Yang is actually a bit of a plain English change this interface on to support these VLANs, to support these speeds, to support these devices, block these MAC addresses. So that configuration change is all going to be done in Yang. And what's kind of funny is Yang stands for yet another next generation language.
Oh, I thought it was something yin and yang.
No. Yet another. Actually, there's a great Wikipedia article on Yang. So if you really want to learn about Yang, go hit Wikipedia and look for Yang, Y-A-N-G, and you'll see how the definition language is being put together. So I look at it and it's like, this is really sensibly done because you figure anybody with a network understanding is going to be able to create these configurations. You guys rock. Create these configurations that are plain text describing what should be done. So it's going to really help that documentation. So as I realize everyone's reading here, so Brian, to your point about carriers and ISPs, they're really wanting to adopt this simply because it allows them business flexibility to be able to do all of the, whether you say good things or you say mischievousness that is against the net neutrality. So whether you're for it or against it, it's the fact that those carriers want to be able to say, we want to offer services to people. And it's the complexity of those services saying, well, we want to offer fast streaming to Google and slow streaming to Microsoft, or the reverse, or this person has paid for a gaming package, so they're going to be able to get great World of Warcraft performance, but they didn't do Destiny 2. So all of those customizations are things that creates an incredible amount of complexity in their network, but allows them to charge for it. That's the sort of stuff they want to be able to push out to control that network. And NetConf is going to be one avenue that allows them to do it.
Okay, I want to throw it over to Bam, because I think he has some questions about the actual protocol itself, right, Bam?
Just how does it compete with what we see right now is the movement towards DevOps, CI/CD, continuous deployment, continuous delivery, and the treatment now of infrastructure as code or configuration as code. And the way that's being mostly achieved right now is through the implementation of declarative APIs, which is very similar. You know, we'll use principles of Yang as well. And what I'm wondering is NetConf competing with that, or is it something that's complementary to it? You know, that, you know, we definitely see I see a push pull from what my interactions and my day to day at F5. And though I'm not regularly engaged with the service providers, I don't hear a lot about NetConf in the enterprise. So I'm wondering where you see this. Do you see this? You know, so maybe there's two questions here. One is, does this compete with like the movement towards declarative APIs and things like that in network equipment? And also, do you see this technology really trickling down out of the service providers into the enterprise space?
So I'll answer the second question first. Is I do see it trickling down to the enterprise. The reason the enterprises can't do it yet is that their network equipment is still too diverse. Again, they've got some HP, they've got some Juniper, they've got a little bit of Cisco here and there, you know, some Extreme. And so they have the dog's breakfast that they have to support. And so they can't do it until all of that equipment, or I should say the majority of that equipment, is going to be able to support NetConf. So they're in a mode now where if there's a vendor, you know, like F5, you guys provide an API that they can say, let's do some coding to that API. That's fantastic. That gives them the middle ground of solving a business problem today. Again, it'll probably be 4 or 5 years before they can do a full network refresh and say, this stuff is all going to be refreshed with stuff that supports NetConf. But the carriers, they're able to end up refreshing their network and also create standards that say, every device on this network is going to be NetConf support. And really what they want is they want to be able to have Salesforce and have a salesperson say, hey, I just closed this business, put the order in, and that order goes all the way through the system, hits billing, creates the bill for the customer, and also configures the router with the new services that they want, and not a single person had to open a CLI. And that's the automation that they want to put in place, which is very smart, it's very efficient, and it's really required for their business, and they can demand it out of the vendors because they're going to say, these are the 5 devices we're going to have on our network. We're not going to have the old 3Com hub in the finance group that supports that one printer. They're not going to have those sort of problems.
So right. A quick follow-up on that, Tim. What do you think? So you said, you know, they'll code some stuff towards an API. So obviously they're investing in tooling and infrastructure, managing these systems. What do you think it's going to take, you know, beyond sort of broad adoption to kind of shift, you know, the enterprise environments towards the adoption of NetConf once they've already tooled their infrastructure for these APIs? Sort of when, you know, they've done the thing to get the business value, as you said, in the interim. You know, I'm wondering what you see as the challenges, because the cost of change is one of the things I see as being the biggest obstacle. Change is hard. And so how do we ease that? You know, how do we get people to adopt something that should make our lives better, more reliable, fewer trouble tickets on a weekend?
Well, it's going to be a slow adoption again because the wide variety of equipment that the enterprise folks have to support. I kind of look at this and say there's a wonderful parallel in the automotive industry, is that you have internal combustion engines, you have hybrid cars, and then you have full electric cars. in a certain sense, those hybrid cars are awesome. They're a great middle ground to folks who are not ready to make the conversion to full electric. But as we've kind of seen, you know, with the latest Super Bowl ad, and also hearing news from General Motors, it's like every car company is going to be going electric. But if you want something that's really efficient with gas right now, hybrid's a perfectly good choice. But I would expect 10 years from now, maybe even 20 years from now, nobody's going to be buying hybrid. It's going to be buying an electric car, or you're still buying a gas car because it has certain things that you need. And that hybrid is going to slowly disappear because it was a stopgap between the two.
So I want to throw this over to Mo next, because I think she's been chomping at the bit here. She's has some comments and questions as well.
Yeah, well, okay, I can't speak to the Super Bowl ad because I didn't see it. But I have taken a ride in your Tesla, so I know how you feel about electric cars. I have a couple of questions. I think I'm going to stick with just asking you. Earlier you said something about there's about a 10% adoption rate right now. With Cisco and Juniper being the 800-pound gorillas that have been really driving this, what do you think it's going to take to get to reach the critical mass and that you're predicting?
Well, haven't thought about that specifically, but I'm thinking that maybe if Cisco and Juniper obviously continue in their carrier space to be successful with that, they're going to want to be able to talk about using business rules to control your network. I think I'm probably going to goof this. I think Cisco has their DNS service where they allow you to dynamically reconfigure your network. Is that the technology? Am I forgetting the technology? Cisco came out with a technology just about a year ago, year and a half ago, but it allows you to dynamically change your network based upon business rules, and they're just starting down that path. But it's Cisco only. So it will only work on certain Cisco devices. But people look at that and say, wow, this is the promised land, because you can have a school network that says, gee, all of these school sites can access the training servers. But after 5 p.m., the network reconfigures itself for night school, where they can't access those grade school servers anymore. They can only access the night school servers. They're on a different VLAN, perhaps. So it's being able to dynamically change that network, but do it not just for Cisco, but do it system-wide or industry-wide is really the trick. If companies say, I need that technology today, they're going to look at Cisco for that. If they say, I need that technology and it has to support other than Cisco because we're unwilling to pay for, you know, what Cisco is charging for it, because every new technology tends to be expensive when it first comes out, they're going to push that to say, Juniper, you need to support this. Cisco, you need more of your equipment to support this. Extreme, you need to support this. And by that point, there's going to be enough companies that say, yes, we all have devices that support NetConf and Yang to be able to do this configuration. And at that point, you just look for a NetConf configuration orchestrator, and you're going to be able to control the entire infrastructure and put business rules in place. And you don't have to necessarily be a network expert saying, gee, what was the command to do that? And I'll admit to you guys, I log into a device, I have to sit there and search the backs of my brain to find out what is the command talking to this device to get this to work. And some of the times I'm just piecing it together with a question mark and saying, oh, that's the command. Okay, question mark, that's the command, and build that out. All that's going to be gone, which is, if you ask me, a good thing.
So really quick, Tim, I hear a lot of buzz in the area around this, around NFV, which is there's a lot of interest around what they call network function virtualization. How does this compare, and why would somebody go to that instead versus NetConf or vice versa?
So when you say network function virtualization, I'm going to apologize and say that's a term I haven't researched. But what I'm thinking about it describes is that you're going to be able to have services that are located separate from the network, meaning you'll have a service that is part of Amazon's cloud service, something also that's part of it is in Azure. And so it's that function is disassociated from a specific subnet. You're not going to a single server somewhere. Is that a correct assumption of what function virtualization is?
Yeah, I think that's essentially right. Like, I think that the idea is it allows you to kind of design your network in a case where you can virtualize it in a sense. And so that this way it kind of decouples the virtualization from the actual functions of the network. So, yeah, I think I'm not really fully familiar with it, but I was just curious because I do hear a lot of the time around people kind of calling out and saying the difference.
What I've heard about that is that I think I remember that now is that you can actually have some part of a subnet in Texas and another part of the same subnet also located in Portland. And so you're thinking it's like, well, this is one subnet, you know, just a single class C subnet where half of that is on one side of the country, half is on the other side of the country. And yet broadcasts are still sent back and forth so that everything works correctly. And so there are certain circumstances where you want that for fault tolerance. I'm just going to say that sounds like a network complexity that is necessary for business in some cases. But as part of that complexity is being able to go and say, let's have the NetConf orchestrator make changes. You can make sure that the orchestrator has rules that prevent you from goofing that configuration up. And I think that's another thing is that the NetConf will help reduce the errors that happen. I got to freely admit is, you know, you will type in a command, you'll press enter and say, yeah, this is the right command. And then realize, uh-oh, I just took down that part of the network because I didn't consider what this whole effect is. And I think there's a lot of network engineers out there that they'll be in the CLI. They'll say it was well thought through. I had it documented as to what I was going to do, but they didn't realize that some other configuration just made it so that you just cause an outage. And so if you had a NetConf orchestrator that was able to push these configs out, but also have rules in the orchestrator that says, when you push this configuration out, do you recognize that this will affect this other subnet, especially those complexities like you have the network virtualization, to prevent you from making those mistakes? So it should help reduce the amount of oops that happens.
You know, and that's exactly one of the reasons why I'm keep hearing about NetConf so much when in the wireless internet service provider world. You know, the issue that I'm seeing is, you know, what I'm seeing driving this is there are quite a few customers that have managed to snag themselves maybe a Class C, but they have multiple sites across a city, and they need to be able to go and have, you know, the ISP do the MPLS magic and software-defined networks magic to be able to go and offer that layer 2 VLAN across multiple buildings across the city. And that level of complexity, I think, is what's kind of driving the interest of NetConf in the WISP world. So, Tim,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, the chances of errors are high in that environment.
Yeah, real high. In fact, that's why you and I have been talking about this, because I'm lighting up a WISP, and TotalView sounds like it might be a really good way of, you know, helping me to catch the oops factor.
That's part of what we've designed it for. We don't do any NetConf today, but it's really all about the root cause troubleshooting of when, where, and why are you dropping packets in the environment, or buffering packets, or misqueuing packets, or sending packets the wrong direction. So that's kind of the core of what we've built our solution to do.
Yeah, I see some. Movement from Mo in the background. Ms. Mo, you seem to have some opinions here.
Well, I'm just, as being like one of the few people on this show that has to live with a WISP for my normal everyday existence, I'm trying to picture this layer 2 connection from Texas to Oregon that's going across a satellite link. How does that work or not work?
That's part of the virtualization. I mean, they're effectively encapsulating a layer 2 packet inside of layer 3 packet and then sending it back over various different layer 2s. But you're getting it, and you're part of the same VLAN. You're able to say,
I understand that, but you're still going 23,000 miles into space and then back again.
So I got to
tell you what my latency is like. I don't want part of my broadcast being in Oregon. It's already past the moon.
I've seen this actually. It's a little weird is that you can sit there on a machine and say, you know, ping this one IP in the subnet and it's nice, low, you know, 1 millisecond, 2 milliseconds. And then you ping an IP address that is the next higher IP address. And as soon as you ping that IP address, it's like 300 milliseconds. And you're like, why is that IP address 300 milliseconds and this IP address 2 milliseconds? And 300 milliseconds works for a data environment.
Oh, darling, I haven't seen 300 milliseconds since I moved out here.
What are you up to?
It's 700.
and we're still seeing your beautiful face, and there's no desynchronization.
I've jury-rigged this setup. I really have.
Fantastic. Well, I think we're running low on time. I wanted to throw over to Bam and then to Gbert for a quick note on some new segments. Bam?
Hey, so I'm thinking to myself, I see how this will work really well at layers 2 and 3. Route and switch, there's a lot of standardization in the protocols and use, and even in the way that they're implemented by the various vendors, be it Juniper, Cisco, what have you. As you go up the layers of the stack towards layer 4, layer 7, the application layer, implementations start to vary a lot more wildly, and what you want to do at those various layers tends to really start to change. So I'm wondering, you know, what kind of adoption can we hope for, you know, as we move up the stack towards more intelligent, you know, security devices in particular. People who've watched the show a little bit know that that's my area of expertise and passion. And so I'm wondering, you know, I think maybe a basic network firewall might be, you know, pretty amenable, basic 5-tuple rules. But when you start to get things like signature-based checking, anti-malware, you know, application layer firewalling, things start to get hairy really quickly. So I'm wondering how adaptable or how amenable a NetConf implementation might be for something more advanced or more complex like the app layer.
I think what you're bringing up is something that is the exact next hurdle for the NetConf working group to overcome. Because what will happen is exactly what you're saying is you're going to say, gee, NetConf, I can put a Palo Alto firewall, I can put a Cisco firewall, I can put an F5 firewall, and it's going to be able to push the config out. The problem is it's not going to have an understanding that when you're dealing with an F5 firewall, you've got so much more depth of options and features and capabilities because it's kind of dumbing it down to a standards-based level. And so coming up with the Yang configuration options to be able to deal with custom capabilities of devices is kind of the next hurdle for them to overcome. I think the first thing is just make it so the stuff will configure and you can automate this. The second thing is how do you get the benefits out of the fact that you have a firewall that has some extreme capabilities versus, gee, if we're just using the NetConf level configuration, then it doesn't make a difference whether we have a Palo Alto firewall, Cisco firewall, F5 firewall. It doesn't make any difference whatsoever because you're using only the base features of it. And so that's kind of the next hurdle for that working group to be able to overcome.
Interesting. Well, Tim, we're running really low on time. We wanted to thank you. We're talking with Tim Tice, CTO of PASS Solutions. Can you tell the folks at home where they can go learn more about this, as well as where they can go and learn more about PASS Solutions and so on?
Yeah, just www.passsolutions.com. We're going to be at Enterprise Connect in March. We're going to be at Cisco Live in June. If you drop by our booth, we have turtles. So we've got a ton of these that we're going to be giving away at Cisco Live. Glad to meet you guys at Cisco Live. Mention that you heard from us for Twyatt, but this is our turtle, and we'll just have these for you guys if you drop by the booth.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Tim. Before we close up, folks, we do want to throw it over to Gbert really quick. He has some comments about some new segments coming up.
So a lot of people have been hitting me saying, hey, you guys have done some great topics, but we want more. And so today was kind of an experiment. You notice we didn't do any bites today, so that gave us another 15 minutes to play with. So what I'd love to hear is from the folks that have been listening to this. You know, throw me an email, gbert@twit.tv. Did you like it? Do you want more? And what we're looking at doing is possibly taking, say, like some real in-depth, maybe get BAM to do a segment on some of the F5 stuff. We're talking about possibly doing one on MPLS, maybe some SDN, different type of things. You folks have been throwing a lot of stuff at me. So some of the stuff needs longer segments. So I'm thinking maybe of do an pre-record of, say, a 1.5 to 2 hour thing, you know, topic of whatever, and then hacking it up and then sliding in maybe half or a quarter either before or after Twyatt. So I want to know, what do you guys think? And did you like this? You know, I kind of don't want to do the show in a vacuum. Production is hard work, and I'd like to make sure we're going to try and hit things that you folks actually want to see and hear.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chiebert. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 Yang data models. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-host in crime, starting with Ms. Heather Williams. Thank you again for being here. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
Well, my snarky work is on Twitter at MoBetterWiFi, where I speak for myself and not for Ruckus. But you can catch me with Ruckus Deals with I'm going to be at a lot of conferences this year. So starting with RSA. Well, actually, I guess starting with Black Hat in Singapore, and then RSA will follow on after that. And after that, Fantastic. Who knows?
Fantastic. Thanks, Mo. Of course, we have to thank our friend, Mr. Brian McHenry. Brian, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you, all of your work and F5 Network stuff?
You can always find me on Twitter at BA McHenry. That's where the BAM comes from my middle initial. And if you get me on Twitter, maybe I'll even tell you what that stands for. But if you want to see what's going on, I'm going to put a little plug in for some free training from F5, f5.com/supernetops. So if you're trying to figure out how to get from a command line network operations person like I cut my teeth as for 10 years into this whole DevOps movement and how to automate your infrastructure like we've been talking about today, F5 provides some free training called Super NetOps training to help bridge the gap and help you learn how to automate and orchestrate your infrastructure. So go on over, check it out. It's free training, free labs, get hands-on and figure out how to get into this next generation of network management and monitoring.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot, Ben. Of course, we can never forget our loyal producer, everyone's favorite geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, where can they find all of your work, and where can they get a hold of you if they need to talk about the show?
Again, my snark also is at ADVNETLAB on Twitter. Love to hear from you folks. I'm Chiebert at twit.tv, but better yet, why don't you use Twyatt at twit.tv, and that way it'll hit all the hosts, and love to hear from you. You guys have been sending me lots of great show ideas, and yeah, I've gotten a few trolls, but you know, that's right. Trolls will be trolls, right?
That's right. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well, to the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to the show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise news. So go to the show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, plus all the show notes around co-host information, guest information, and links to the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to the videos, you'll get those helpful download and subscribe links. Support the show by getting your audio version of choice, video version of your choice, HD video version. Listen on any one of your devices. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. After you subscribe, share the show with your friends and family and coworkers. We love doing the show, and if they subscribe, we can keep doing it. Now, also remember, we should do the show live each and every week at 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays, live.twit.tv. Come and see how the show is running behind the scenes. And if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well go ahead and jump into the chat room as well and check it out live as well, irc.twit.tv. Also, don't forget, you can follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I'll post all of my work as well as some of the things I'm doing outside of work. About the snowpocalypse that's happening outside here in the Pacific Northwest. So go check that out. Of course, I work at Microsoft, so you can check out all of my work at microsoft.dev.office.com about extending Office and making it more productive for you. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa, who continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech. Also, I want to thank all the engineers at Twit, and of course, our loyal producer, Mr. Brian Chi. He's our tireless producer. He does all the bookings and setting ups of the show, so thank you so much for doing that each and every week. Now, before we sign out, it's today. We have to go back to Victor here. Victor, hopefully you've been listening here. What was the main topic of this show, man?
Something about a babblefish.
Well played. Well played.
Well played.
But Twyatt is my babblefish for what you guys are talking about.
Sounds good. Okay. We feel very, very, very helpful there. Thank you, sir. Well, until next time, I don't think you got it this time, but maybe next time. And of course, and until next time, I'm Louis Marasca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twyatt.